Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing. On 88.9 KUCI-FM, we are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents who discuss the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Ginger Strand and T.C. Boyle. First up is Ginger Strand. Ginger has worked as a teacher, waitress in a roadhouse, secretary in an advertising agency, test question writer for ETS, alternative film critic, studio assistant for an environmental artist, transcriber of psychiatric sessions, box office manager in an off-Broadway theater, and hostess in a Polynesian restaurant. Many of these jobs simultaneously. She is either unemployable or far too employable for her own good. Throughout this varied employment history, she's never stopped writing. Her fiction and essays have appeared in many places, including Harper's, The Believer, The Iowa Review, The Gettysburg Review, Raritan, The New England Review, and Carolina Quarterly. She's been awarded fiction residencies by the McDowell Colony, Yaddo, and the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. She received a Tennessee Williams Scholarship in Fiction by the Sewanee Writers Conference and has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She has a PhD in English from Princeton and lives in New York City. Hi, Ginger. Where's Ginger? Hi.
I'm here.
Oh, great. There you are. I was so afraid I lost you. Your new novel, Flight, is so interesting. Your point of view character is a man approaching 60. Mm-hmm. Tell me about choosing to tell your story from this point of view, how this evolved.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It wasn't necessarily a conscious decision. It was more just which character sort of elbowed his way to the front and insisted on getting most of my attention. And it probably, I don't know, it's maybe not a surprise, but it turned out to be the kind of patriarch, the father, the ex-Air Force pilot, the kind of macho guy. He just became very interesting to me and demanded to take center stage. I was originally working on a collection of short stories, and when I reconceived the book at my agent's suggestion as a novel, I realized that somebody had to take center stage, and it was pretty clear to me who that was going to be.
Hmm. So Flight takes place in the spring of 2002,
mm-hmm.
and with shadows of 9/11 throughout. Would you talk about sort of the genesis of the story?
The present day story?
Yeah.
Novel or,
yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, when I was working on this short story collection before 9/11 happened, and then I was putting it together as a novel afterwards, and I live three blocks from the World Trade Center site, so it was very much top of mind for me. And I realized I had to make a decision about the main character being a pilot. Was I going to set this pre-9/11 or post-9/11? And if it was post-9/11, that was going to weigh very heavily in his mind and in the minds of everyone, as it does, I think, still. So I decided to set it in that particular spring because it kind of coalesced a lot of the things that I was thinking about at the time, not just in relation to that event, but just generally, you know, how we move forward, thinking of a wedding plot is always a little bit about that uneasy relationship between the past and the future. You know, how do you move forward? How do you march forward into your future? How do you deal with the things that are in your past and bring them with you as you go forward? How do you cope with uncertainty, with the fact that you never really know how something's going to work out? I think that's always a kind of specter that's raised by a wedding. You know, it's this public gesture of certainty that we make, but it's, you know, there's always that question that runs underneath it.
Mm-hmm. And your main character, Will, is a pilot,
mm-hmm.
has flown for years. Talk about that. And did the idea of him being a pilot, I mean, it was obviously such a part of what happened on 9/11, but what was that obvious? Was that one of the early parts of your stories that then became this novel?
I think it was. You know, my own father was a pilot, and the character, some aspects of the character are based on my father. My father did not see active service or fly for the Air Force, but he was a commercial pilot for 35 years, and I really... I started to see his career as a kind of parallel for kinds of changes that have happened in our culture that I wanted to talk about, the change from the kind of optimism and excitement in the 1960s to the and through the early 70s, and then, you know, deregulation and concerns about the early wave of concerns about terror and the early oil crisis and things like that, on into the kind of heyday of corporate, you know, raiders in the 80s and on up to our present day climate. It just seemed like the airline industry really tracked a lot of those things for me. And having grown up with it and grown up in it and gone through it, it was an easy thing for me to turn to kind of think about the changes that have happened in the last 30 years in our culture.
Mm.
And I used to, of course, I, you know, stole a lot of my father's stories too, because I was always, my father was a brilliant, has always been a brilliant storyteller. And, you know, he would captivate everyone at the dinner table at night with the story of, you know, the engine that caught on fire, or the, you know, the sandstorm that hit the plane or something. Everyone was always gripped. So it was easy to kind of take those stories and use them for my own purposes.
Sure.
Change them in some cases, or add or subtract.
And yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ginger Strand, author of Flight, published by Simon and Schuster. So the book began as several short stories that you were talked into turning into a novel. What I mean, that is not
that
you don't
cool.
hear this very often. I mean, how I guess if you love writing novels, this is an ideal scenario.
Yeah, you know, I never was opposed to writing a novel. I just always thought that I was too flighty and dilettantish, and I wouldn't have the attention span
mm-hmm.
or the energy or the gumption to finish it. So I could never really sit down to write a novel because I would think, you can't write a novel. Don't be ridiculous. And I ended up writing a whole bunch of short stories that were about the same characters and became linked, and then they became a kind of novel in stories. And I showed them to an agent, and he said, "Well, you know, why are you doing this as a novel in stories? Why don't you just write a novel?" And I thought, well, you know, okay. Actually, I was a little depressed about it for a while, but I went back and rethought the whole thing, and it turned out to be a great way to kind of write a first novel, because I knew everything that I needed to know about my characters, and I felt a great deal of confidence in moving them around on the drawing board and kind of putting them into a situation and seeing how they would behave.
So the stories, I imagine, had their own arc and plot or what have you, and then moving into novel form, what did you do with that? I mean, did you have to kind of look at all the pieces and create an outline or a new major plot, or what did you do?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? Because a collection of linked stories works in a different way, and I think it's actually a very beautiful form. And I was doing something a little more abstract with the linked stories. I think I was really trying to think about family history, and the stories were told from the different perspectives of the people in the family, and they moved back and forth in time, but it was slowly cumulative. I think when you're dealing with a novel, at least with this particular novel, I just decided to give it a very strong plot, a very kind of, you know, at every turn, question of what are they going to do next, what secrets are going to be revealed, what's going to happen to these people, is she going to marry him, is she not going to marry him, is the, you know, are the police going to arrive, are they not? At one point I even threw in a sort of car chase, you know, not really a car chase, but it seemed like, you know, I thought I would play with that, you know, very specific forward movement that the novel has, what do academics call it? The teleology, right?
Mm-hmm.
That drive to move forward. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And then the other parts of the things that I knew about the characters and the stories that I had worked on before and the kinds of background came in as background and as character development. So I did write an entirely new plot when I wrote it as a novel.
Interesting.
And then everything hung from that. It was sort of the spine, you know, what drama critics say, that great drama always has a spine.
The spine of the story.
From it, yeah.
Will you read to us from Flight?
Sure.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. Ginger Strand is going to read from her novel Flight.
This is just a short section from the first chapter where the soon-to-be bride is come flying home from Newark to Michigan, to Grand Rapids, Michigan. She is a little upset because she hasn't found a way to tell her soon-to-be husband that she has a drinking problem. So they're sitting on an airplane. And she has, as we all tend to do in times of great stress, she has fallen asleep. So that's the setup. Leanne wakes up when someone screams. Her head has been leaning sideways, and her neck is so sore she holds it still, avoiding any quick movement. As she reaches a hand up to massage it slowly back into place, the plane pitches violently to the left and snaps her upright. She leans out into the aisle. Everyone else in the cabin looks frozen, some sleeping or feigning sleep, others simply holding still. The only movement is a synchronous bobbing of heads as the plane commences a strange, shuddery wobbling. There's another stomach-churning jolt, and Leanne turns to Kit. That's the fiancé. He has his hands clenched together in front of his stomach and is holding himself in an oddly tight way. His face is pale, but he smiles at her. Her heart jumps with concern, and in that moment, it's clear to her that she loves him. She reaches a hand out and touches their fingertips to his bald fists. Because of the plane's wobble, they tap up and down on the back of his hand as if she's trying to wake him. "What's going on?" she whispers. "Turbulence," he says. She notices that his knuckles are stretched thin and white with tension. "Someone screamed." It takes him a moment to reply. "Bad turbulence," he says. He takes a deep breath, and Leanne realizes that his tight posture and pale countenance are the result not of fear, but of nausea. She leans forward and paws through her seatback magazine compartment. There's an in-flight magazine, an in-flight catalog, an in-flight entertainment guide, and a couple of crumpled napkins. Don't airlines provide air sickness bags anymore, or were they somehow a security problem, too? "I'll be okay," Kit says, his voice slightly strained. "I almost never get motion sick." "I heard it helps if you use the pressure points on your wrists," Leanne holds out a forearm and encircles one wrist with her other hand, pressing her thumb down where it's supposed to help. Kit looks as amused as a nauseated man possibly can. "My God, why didn't I think of that?" he says. The plane drops what feels like 50 feet. The falling sensation is scary, but there's a deep throb of pleasure in it, too. Leanne thinks of her father. He fell from the sky once when his fighter jet was shot down in Vietnam, and he parachuted into the ocean. Was there a thrill in the long ride down? It's funny, she's never heard him talk about it. Somehow the subject of the war was one they all left alone, even though it was always there, a shadow. The plane shakes and accelerates, and the overhead compartments creak. One of them has a rattling door that looks like it might give way at any moment. Leanne looks out the window. The sky is white, giving no clue about why the air should be so choppy. The plane seems to be descending, but there's no ground visible beneath them, just shreds of white on top of thick white soup. She tries Kit's approach, pressing her body back into her seat. When she was small, airplanes seemed so big. Of course, there really were more spacious then, before the airlines started cramming in as many bodies as they could. Things were more elegant, too. Leanne remembers dressing up to fly. When she was 3, the family took their first trip abroad to London. Carol bought Leanne and Margaret matching fur hats and muffs. They took a 747, and the upstairs was a piano bar. At dinner time, an attendant came to their seats and carved a Chateaubriand. The plane drops again, and Leanne reflexively grips her armrests. It would have been easier to die in those days, she thinks. You'd have gone out in a blaze of glamour like Princess Diana in the back seat of a speeding limo. Now it would be like falling off a cliff in a Greyhound bus. Leanne imagines the plane ripping apart, crammed overhead compartments disgorging their cargo, passengers melding with their downsized economy seats. Pretzel bags, plastic cups, and fanny packs would fuel the fireball. This is always how it is in the air. Part of her believes with all her heart that these are her last moments on Earth. What else is there to believe, thousands of feet in the air, powerless inside a small metal tube, tossed and jolted around like so much baggage? Every bump, every jerk, is like a message from the higher power of nature. You do not matter. You are insignificant in the greater course of things. And yet, another part of her cannot believe that anything could possibly happen to her here, not because of the statistical safety of airline travel, not because, as her father always told them, more people die of bee stings than plane crashes, but because this is not her life. The airplane is nowhere, merely a conduit from one part of her life to another. Cold Spring, her store, her East Coast friends, all these dwindled in significance the moment the plane rumbled into the air and turned them into tiny, toy-like objects. At the same time, the realities of Michigan, her family, the home she grew up in, exist only as ghosts stored in her memory. This nowhere enfolds her above and outside her real life, which will restart when she lands in Michigan with her fiancé, greets her parents, drives to Ryeville, and 2 days later walks down an improvised aisle outdoors at the Green Lake Country Club to become a married person. That is her real life, opening before her like a brightly lit corridor. Even the dark spots are already visible. Margaret, her sister, will inevitably find fault with some aspect of Leanne's dress. Her cousin Eddie will find the most inopportune moment to call her by her old nickname, Pester. Some simmering tension between her parents will make everyone uncomfortable. These things seem so certain that there's something exhilarating, almost glorious, in the idea that they might not occur. And so she sits, suspended between two certainties, the certainty of her imminent annihilation and the certainty of the life mapped out for her. She shifts in her seat. Kit, she says, I have to tell you something.
Thank you so much. Ginger Strand reading from Flight, published by Simon & Schuster. That's such a great section. I'm always just riveted to writing as yours, especially when it is about flight. You know, things on planes perhaps going a little wrong. I don't know quite why that is, because I am definitely a fearful flyer, and I fly quite a bit, I guess. But, you know, it's just great. I really, really enjoy that.
I think we're all kind of riveted by that. I mean, it's an experience it's very much part of, you know, daily life almost nowadays. It's pretty common. People fly all the time. And yet there's something very deep about it. You know, it strikes a very deep chord in us every time the plane takes off. I'm not a fearful flyer, but I still, you know, it feels like a very intense emotional experience every time I fly.
That's interesting. That's interesting that you're not a fearful flyer, and yet it does feel that way. Because I always think, if I were relaxed about this, I would, I'd be doing something else.
You know. No, it's still deeply unnatural. You know, there you are, up in the. You're not supposed to be up there. It's just weird. It severs us from the world. And I mean, I think that's partly why I was attracted to the metaphor as a central metaphor for the book. It's really. There's something very fundamental about who you are when you're up there in the sky. You're sort of, you know, you're detached from everything else and just a body in a tiny metal tube.
Yes. Well, we have a couple of minutes left, and before we go, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the revision process, only because your language is so clean, and your metaphors, similes, your word choices seem very, very deliberate and natural, but definitely worked over the way good writing is worked over. And I'm curious about this. Now, you may tell me that you revised the book once and that was it, and I'm totally wrong, but talk about that. I mean, like, was the beginning, and was your revision process extensive or not so?
It's a good question. I think it. I'm a pretty extensive reviser. I tend to, you know, given if somebody didn't pull it out of my hands, I believe the DHL man was standing in my apartment as I was making the last revisions beforehand. He was like, give it. I was like, no. My joke about it is always that the first chapter is the best written, because every time I opened up the document on my computer, there was the first chapter, and I was just compelled to go through it once more and kind of prune the words or think very hard about word choices. I tried to focus in the revision process. You know, there's a round of revisions that I did for plot and for you know, just mechanical things, and then I did a round of revision where I just really focused on each character's voice. And is this the word that Margaret would use, or is this more the word that Will would use? You know, I try to think about the language, you know, in writing close in third person, the language that each character was thinking in. And then I had, you know, the good luck to have a very attentive editor who did a round of, actually my agent did a round of revisions with me first, and then my editor did a round. And then I had a really brilliant copy editor at Simon & Schuster who questioned me on every word choice. Is this the word you really want? Is this, you know, you said this word 2 pages ago. Are you sure you want to say it again here? I mean, she noticed things that I had no idea I had done. You know, there was one point where a character was wearing, I think, peach silk shantung, which was a fabric that someone else had worn 100 pages earlier. And she said, "Did you want this repetition to happen?" And I was like, "Wow, no, I didn't." You know, it just that fabric somehow came to mind for me twice. So I was fortunate in having a good editing team as well in doing that.
Interesting. We're at the end of our time. Any advice for the writers listening?
You know, in thinking about the people I've worked with, I always think that the best thing that I've done is taken advice. You know, I try not to be defensive about my writing, and really, if someone says, "I think this is the wrong word," I really try to, if I'm absolutely convinced it's the right word, I need to have a good reason for myself. And I think being able to take advice is the only way you can grow as a writer, and being able to learn from other writers as well. But that would be my advice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome, and continued good luck on this book.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. That was Ginger Strand, author of Flight, published by Simon & Schuster, speaking to us from New York. When we return, we'll be back with T.C. Boyle, so please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One bit in a day, let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I should say, before we go on, that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. We spent our first half hour with Ginger Strand, author of Flight. We are back with T.C. Boyle. T. Craigson Boyle is the author of 17 books of fiction, including, most recently, After the Plague, Drop City, The Inner Circle, and Tooth and Claw. He received a PhD in 19th century British literature from the University of Iowa in 1977, his MFA from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1974, and his BA in English and History from SUNY Potsdam, 1968. He's been a member of the English department at the University of Southern California since 1978. His books are available in a number of foreign languages, including German, French, Italian, Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish, Russian, Hebrew, Korean, Japanese, Danish, Swedish, Lithuanian, Latvian, Polish, Hungarian, and Bulgarian. His stories have appeared in most of the major American magazines, including The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, The Atlantic Monthly, Playboy, The Paris Review, GQ, Antaeus, Granta, and McSweeney's, and he's been a recipient of a number of literary awards. He lives near Santa Barbara with his wife and children. Hi, Tom. Are you there? I don't hear him. Let me try to get him on again and see what happened here. So all of you out there, after that wonderful intro, I want you to stay with me, and I'm going to find out why I cannot hear him. So don't go anywhere. And we are back, and I believe we have T.C. Boyle on the line. Are you there?
You do indeed.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
You are so prolific. I don't know quite how you do this. I mean, you seem to come out with a book of quality every year.
Well, I'll tell you, Barbara, it's very, very simple economics. If I didn't have a book every year, what with the way my family spends money, I would be out right now bugging commuters, rattling change in a cup.
But the thing is, the books are good. Every book that you put out is good, and it'd be one thing to just, you know.
I was only kidding, of course. this is my life. This is what I do, and everything that I put out, I believe in. It's part of my life's work, and so yes, I've been productive, but I've been very lucky in that I'm able to work all year round on whatever I like.
Hmm. So do you work on your short stories, this Tooth and Claw is a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. Do you work on short stories between novels, or might you be
yes.
working on a novel and a short story comes to you? How does that work?
Yes. Yes, I'm very much a control freak. Everything in its place. I've never worked on two things at once because I always fear that, I will get to some rough spot. We all have rough spots in our stories and novels, usually the middle, by the way, because that's when you have to figure out what's going on. And I'm always afraid that I would then turn to the other piece and never get either one of them done. So I have periods in which I write stories and periods in which I write novels. Now, this sounds like a kind of leading question. What's next? Well, I just finished a novel this spring for next summer. It's called Talk Talk, and I can tell you more about that in a minute. But in the meanwhile, I am working on new short stories, and I expect that, maybe sometime early next year I'll begin a new novel. After that novel is over, I hope to write some more stories, and then we'll have another collection.
Hmm. So, and at the same time, you teach.
Yes, I do.
Now,
I've just entered, just begun my 28th year teaching in the English department at USC, and I've always been terrible with math, but I'm trying to figure out how old I am. I must have started when I was 8 years old. I must have been a real prodigy.
I find this, it's really interesting. I mean, your name has come up as somebody who is such a successful writer and continues to teach as if once you're successful, you should stop teaching.
Well, I've been kind of bullheaded, but and lucky too, in that I don't do what people expect of me or what other people want or think I should do with my work or with my life. Sure, I could have written some screenplays or essays or done other things, but I have never wanted to. I've always wanted to teach and to write, and as long as I continue moving about on this earth, those are the things I want to do. This is what gives me satisfaction. Why mess with it?
Yes. Good point.
Again, I don't mean to be flippant. USC has been good to me and has given me a schedule which allows me to write. I know that many teachers, particularly at the beginning level in colleges, are saddled with a huge course load, and it really prevents them from doing the kind of work for themselves that they want to do. Again, I've been fortunate in that I've been able to do both and that I have the same schedule I had when I began, which allows me a great deal of free time to pursue my work. And the 2 days in which I do go to USC per week are days in which I'm doing something else. I'm fighting traffic, for one thing, listening to books on tape, and I think contributing something to the love of literature. And I feel good. I get home and I feel really good about that day. I'm tired, I'm aggravated, but I feel good. And somehow that helps me the following day when I go to work on my novel or my stories to have gotten something out of the way, cleared my mind in some way.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T.C. Boyle. His new collection of short stories is called Tooth and Claw, and The Inner Circle has just come out in paperback, has it?
Yes, it's actually a triple whammy going on right now. This is the first interview I'm doing for the tour. I head out to San Francisco on Tuesday and then, points east and everywhere else. Actually, there are three books out. We have the new collection, Tooth and Claw, the paperback of The Inner Circle, about which you and I talked last year.
Mm-hmm.
A book that sold very well and was very well received because, after all, it is 400 pages of pure sex with a little bit of the aggravation of marriage and love thrown in.
Yeah.
And there's also another new book, In Hard and Soft, coming out. I haven't quite seen it yet, but I hear that I will get copies soon. It's called The Human Fly, and it's a young adult title. I didn't write it for young adults. However, one of the editors at Penguin felt that some of these stories would appeal to her constituency, stories that I'd written previously, and I included one new one that had never been published before. And we have 13 stories, mainly that deal with teenagers, out of my collections of stories in the past. So that's out there, too, and I like the idea. I never would write specifically for teenagers. I just write for everybody who knows how to read. And, yes, I've have a big audience among young folks, and that's wonderful. I think they can read whatever they want, but this is a selection especially for them, selected by the editor, And her editorial board, she tells me she has 100 teenagers throughout the country whom she runs things by to see if they're interested. Hmm. And they're interested, I guess. So we have that book, too, The Human Fly, as well.
That's excellent. I love the idea of kids who are not familiar with your work discovering you and what fun that must be.
Yeah,
and
I was very interested to see what the editor, her name is Sharon November, by the way, she works for Viking, Penguin, that whole conglomerate that publishes my books, what she would pick. I didn't have any input in it. I just wanted to see what they would pick. And I thought perhaps they would pick some of the more whimsical tales, like The Human Fly itself, the title story.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some very hard, tough stories in there, like The Love of My Life, which was from my book After the Plague a few years ago, which is about two teens who have a baby and then dispose of that baby in the dumpster at a motel based on something that actually happened. And this is a very tough story. And that's included along with Greasy Lake, one of my well-known stories in the past about teens and so on. So it's a pretty wide gamut of stories. It's not really pandering to them in any way, and I think that's great.
That is great. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about your short stories in your current collection and also short stories I've read of yours over the years and novels of yours as well that I have read. And it seems that your stories are, so many of them are so wacky and whimsical. And I always think of that story about the latex bodysuit. It just, you know,
modern love.
I think of you and I think of that story. And then I think of novels like The Tortilla Curtain, which are not wacky or whimsical at all, but more social or political. And I wonder, I guess I'm wondering if you reserve the wacky for the short form and if the long form for you is more serious.
Well, not necessarily, Barbara. I just do what comes natural and what feels good. There's plenty of whack. Novels too. Look at A Friend of the Earth of the year 2000, when that came out. That is a pretty crazy thing. I mean, it has a hyena in the first line.
Mm-hmm.
Look at The Road to Wellville, for instance, or Budding Prospects, for that matter. I don't know exactly. I write stories and novels to express something that I'm feeling in a mode that seems appropriate, and so I feel that I can use any mode, whether that might be a more satiric mode or a straightforward, realistic mode, totally off the wall. And so of the 14 stories in the new book, for instance, the second one, Swept Away, is about the windiest place in the world, the Isle of Unst, in the Shetland Islands, in which cats go flying by. there's another story set in Chile, where the hole is opened, the ozone hole is opened up over the earth. And then there are stories that are sort of straightforward realism, like Up Against the Wall, the concluding story. I like to feel that a story can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
Many writers are seem very confined, and they write the same sort of thing, which it could be great, and is great, you know, but not for me. For me, I just want to have this variety. I want to surprise you with each story, with each book, each time out. I want to exercise the imagination as best I can.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T.C. Boyle, author of Tooth and Claw, just out, collection of short stories, The Inner Circle, which is in paperback now, and The Human Fly, another collection of stories that's considered young adult, but stories that were published as adult stories.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll have to come out with an old adult book of stories now.
Hey, but start a new genre.
They could actually do that if they wanted. I suppose you could find a 14 or 15 of my stories that have old people in them. You know, I mean, that's basically what it's all about. Which is why I find the whole thing a little bit ridiculous. But we shall see.
Yeah, we shall see. You have a lot of animals in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Did you notice, or did you have the collection together and did you go, well, there's a lot of animals in this book?
Choice B, basically. But once I discovered that, I chose an epigraph for the book, which reflects on my very first book of stories, which you want to talk wacky stories. These are the wackiest stories ever written, mm-hmm. Descent of Man. It was way back in 1979, and I took my title, of course, from Darwin. And so in this book, to reflect on that, this book is called Tooth and Claw, Nature Red in Tooth and Claw from Tennyson. I've chosen a quote from Darwin, and here it is. The Simiidae then branched off into two great stems, the New World and the Old World monkeys. And from the latter, at a remote period, man, the wonder and the glory of the universe, proceeded.
Mm.
So yes, I'm very much aware of that. And I often write about this dialectic between our spiritual or mental beings and our animal beings. It fascinates me and has all my life. And so, yes, once I put this collection together, I began to realize that I might want to reflect on that.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
Oh, I'd be happy to, but I'm not going to read anything that has animals in it.
Okay.
However, if I were to read this entire story, an animal plays a large role, a significant role at the end. I'd like to read you a little bit of the beginning of a story called Jubilation. It's an I narrative, and it came about in this way. I discovered a few years ago that the Disney Corporation, had built a model village, a model town near Disney World in Florida, and it was people were dying to get in. In fact, there was a huge auction to be homeowners in this place. There were various kinds of homes, from the wealthy to condos and so on. In an attempt to recreate what a real town could be. And so I've invented a town similar to that called Jubilation, and it's my meditation on what it might be like to live there. And I'll give you the opening a bit from this. I don't know if you want me to read for several hours. Or this might take 4 or 5 minutes. Is that
That's
all right?
That's great.
Okay. Jubilation. I've been living in Jubilation for almost 2 years. There's been a lot of change in that time, both for the better and the worse. As you might expect, in any real and authentic town composed of real and authentic people with their ironclad personalities and various personal agendas. But overall, I'd say I'm happy I chose the Contash Corp's vision of community living. I've got friends here, neighbors, people who care about me the way I care about them. We've had our crises, no question about it. Mother Nature has been pretty erratic these past 2 years, and there isn't a man, woman, or child in Jubilation who isn't worried about maintaining property values in the face of all the naysaying and criticism that's come our way. Still, it's the people this whole thing is about, and the people I know are as determined and forward-looking a bunch as any you'd ever hope to find. We've built something here, something I think we can all be proud of. It wasn't easy. From the beginning, everybody laughed behind my back. Everybody said, oh, sure, Jackson, you get divorced, and the first thing you do is fly down to Florida and live in some theme park with Gulpy Gator and whoever, Chouchy the Lizard, right? And you defend it with some tripe about community and the new urbanists, and we're supposed to say you're behaving rationally? My ex-wife was the worst, Lauren. She made it sound as if I was personally going to drive the Skylift or slip into a Gulpy suit and greet people at the gates of Contash World. But the truth is, I was a pioneer. I had a chance to get into something on the ground floor and make it work, sacrifice to make it work. And all the cynics I used to call friends just snickered in their apple martinis as if my post-divorce life was some opera bouffe stage for their amusement. Take the lottery. They all thought I was crazy, but I booked my ticket, flew down to Orlando, and took my place in line with 6,000 strangers while the sun peeled the skin off the tip of my nose and baked through the soles of my shoes. There was sleet on the runway at LaGuardia when the plane took off, a foot and a half of snow expected in the suburbs, and it meant nothing to me, not anymore. The palms were nodding in a languid tropical breeze. The chiggers, no-see-ums, and mosquitoes were all on vacation somewhere. Children scampered across the emerald grass, and vigorous little birds darted in and out of the jasmine and hibiscus. It was early yet, not quite 8. People shuffled their feet, tapped their watches, gazed hopefully off into the distance, while 100 Contash greeters moved up and down the line with crullers and styrofoam cups of coffee. The excitement was contagious, and yet it was inseparable from a certain element of competitive anxiety. This was a random drawing, after all, and there would necessarily have to be winners and losers. Still, people were outgoing and friendly, chatting among themselves as if they'd known one another all their lives, sharing around cold cuts and homemade potato salad, swapping stories. Everybody knew the rules. There was no favoritism here. Charles Kontash was founding a town, a prêt-à-porter community set down in the middle of the vacation wonderland itself, with Kontash World on one side and Game Park USA on the other. And if you wanted in, no matter who you were or who you knew, you had to stand in line like everybody else.
Hmm.
I think we'll stop there.
Thank you so much. That was T.C. Boyle reading from Jubilation in his new collection, Tooth and Claw, published by Viking. We have a couple of minutes left. Not enough here. And before we go, I want to find out when you are going to be in the L.A. area for the local listeners.
Well, I have to consult my schedule to find that out.
Since you live here.
Your schedules are very complicated. In fact, my editor, Paul Slovak, says eventually, instead of publishing a book, we'll just publish the collected tour schedule. I am poking through it right here, right now, and it looks as if Thursday, September 15th at 7 o'clock, I will be doing my stand-up and giving a reading and signing books and chatting with people. Sponsored by Dutton's Beverly Hills at the Beverly Hills Public Library, 444 North Rexford Drive, Beverly Hills.
And are your appearances on your website? They must be, huh?
Yes. You can go to tcboyle.com, and on the latest What's New column, you'll find what you need to know. And by the way, someone had asked me about bloggers, you know. I had never heard the term blogging until about a year ago. But then I realized that, wait a minute, I'm a blogger myself.
You are.
One of the original ones, because you may know my son Milo, when he was in high school, put up my website, invented my website, tcboyle.com. And from the beginning, that was 1999, August 99, and from the beginning, each month, I put up a little, you know, what's new, what am I doing, what am I thinking, what am I working on, where am I going to be? So, here I am, a blogger.
One of the original bloggers.
Yep.
And there's so much on your website. It's check it out, tcboyle.com. There's so much there to keep you busy for a while. And we're at the end of our time. I always ask this. I'm going to ask it again. Any advice for the writers listening who are perhaps moving along in a project, perhaps more slowly than they like?
You have to stick to it. You have to be a fanatic. I don't know what... luck is involved, of course, but I think... And talent, yes, of course. But there's a huge pool of talent, which is one thing that keeps me teaching. I'm just amazed at how brilliant each generation, each class of students is. In terms of talent. But whether they will emerge as writers or not depends upon how committed they are. And a commitment has to be absolutely and utterly fanatical. And as I've said before, too, if you want to be a writer of fiction or poetry in this world, the first requirement is to have very, very wealthy parents. I didn't. I'm the exception to the rule.
And what's the second requirement?
Oh God, well, we've already spoken about that. You know, you have to put your nose to it. And, of course, for beginning writers, you need to read very widely among your contemporaries so that you have a sense of what art is and what it is to be an artist in this time, not simply to read the classics, although that's important, too, but to know what's happening now and to be very involved in it.
Hmm. Well... thank you, and not that you need it, but best of luck with your new books. And,
okay, Barbara, we didn't get to talk about the new novel, Talk, but we'll talk about it.
When it comes out.
Summer. How's that? It comes out in July.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's T.C. Boyle speaking to us from north of L.A., where he lives. And his new book is Tooth and Claw by Viking, also a young adult collection of short stories, The Human Fly. And his novel, The Inner Circle, is now in paperback. In any case, go to tcboyle.com, and you can see a very extensive schedule. He's going to be all over the place, Boston, New York, D.C., Miami, St. Louis, and wherever you reside, in this country at least, you can see him. And he's quite an entertainer, as you might be able to tell from just listening to him now. If you want to know more about me, actually more about the show, go to penonfire.com and click on the radio tower. And there you will find out who's going to be on next and everything that you ever wanted to know about this show. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Saul Stein, who said, "Tension is created in those delicious moments of anxious uncertainty." Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.
Disregard what don't concern you. Don't let disappointment turn you. Avoid adopting other people's view. Know what you can and can't control. And don't let envy take a toll. It's nothing more than weather passing through. When your back's against the wall, when you're headed far away,